This is The Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Last weekend, the Oscar for Best Documentary went to a film called Free Solo, which captures the rope-free climb of Alex Honnold up the awe-inspiring face of El Capitan and Yosemite National Park. Nobody had ever done a free solo climb of El Cap, and it had previously been considered impossible. Free solo climbers use no ropes or equipment, so a single slip-up could mean a fatal fall to Earth. New Hampshire author and climber Mark Sinnott has climbed with Honnold before, and on the day of Honnold's big climb, he watched him make his way up El Cap through binoculars. In his new book, The Impossible Climb, Sinnott gives an account of what led up to that day. The history and the evolution of climbing culture serve as a frame for Honnold's daring feat, and Sinnott joins me now from his home in Jackson. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. This is an honor. I've been listening to you for many, many years.
Oh, great. Well, glad to have you as a listener. So for those who don't quite get the magnitude of Honnold's achievement, could you tell us about how significant it was for the sport that Alex Honnold climbed the 3,000 feet of El Capitan without any ropes?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I tried to lay out in the book, just the idea that this, you know, is certainly the greatest rock climb ever done. It might be the greatest climb ever done. And I think it was the New York Times that said it was the greatest or one of the greatest athletic feats ever. Tommy Caldwell, you know, who's one of the best climbers in the world today, he called it the moon landing of free soloing. And I think, you know, some lay people were like annoyed that this was equated, you know, with landing on the moon. But to those of us who really understand what it is that Alex did, and we understand the historical context, it does feel like that. And that's something that I was trying to convey in the book. But I think if you don't know anything about climbing and you don't really understand what El Capitan is, it's hard to wrap your head around that idea.
Mm-hmm. So if listeners want to Google a photo of El Cap, as it's called, you might get a sense of how big it is, but I suspect standing at the base of it really gives you the impression of how formidable this is.
Yeah, one of the things that's so amazing about El Capitan is it sits right next to the Loop Road in Yosemite National Park and right next to this beautiful meadow, El Cap Meadow, they call it. And you can park your car and you can walk, you know, 10 or 15 minutes, and it's basically just a flat trail. And then, boom, there's the wall. You know, just basically sticking straight out of the earth and going straight up for 3,000 feet. And you can walk up and you can put your hand on the wall, standing on flat ground, and look up. And it is absolutely awe-inspiring, even, you know, for someone like me. I've climbed it 24 times and I've spent, you know, years of my life in Yosemite, and I still get that same feeling of awe when I see the wall. And it's definitely something that you have to see firsthand to appreciate. Like, a photo just doesn't even remotely do it justice.
One of the ideas you return to time and time again in this book is fear, how climbers in general and how Alex Honnold in particular think about fear, how they manage fear. You're a climber. How do you manage your fear?
It is a process that every climber has to work on. That would be, how to control it. I don't know if we can master it. Even Alex, I don't know, you know, if he has completely mastered it. But when you first learn how to climb and, you know, you dangle on a rope for the first time, it's a scary thing because your instinct just tells you that you're doing something that's not right, because it's not actually normal for us to like hang on the side of cliffs with ropes and things like that. But as you expose yourself to it more and more, you slowly become, you know, accustomed to, you know, this unknown thing that was making you feel fearful, and you become more comfortable with it. And that, I guess you could say that there's kind of a spectrum of how far people are able to go on that arc in terms of learning how to control it. But to be, you know, an elite climber, you have to become very good at that, because you end up in situations where you're clinging to the side of a cliff where if you screw up and you fall, you could get badly hurt. Sometimes you can even get killed even if you have a rope on, because your gear can rip out, you can hit a ledge, or you can, you know, be in like really crazy remote places, like in some of the climbs that I've done, where if you get hurt, it's going to be a really bad scene. And it's only natural that you might get a little panicky when you get into these dangerous positions. But what you learn pretty quickly is that if you let the panic take you over, all it's going to do is make it more likely that the bad outcome is going to occur. So you teach yourself to kind of press the panic down and to keep your cool. I think it's something, you know, real similar that like a lot of athletes go through. But in climbing, you know, it's very unique, and the degree to which Alex has taken, you know, this process that I'm describing is just way beyond, you know, any other climber ever, I think, in the history of the sport.
How is the way that you manage fear different from the way Alex Honnold manages his fear?
Well, I don't know if I'm doing a whole lot of managing fear for myself personally these days. But, you know, yeah, I guess I still do end up in some scary positions sometimes. I think the simple answer is that it's probably similar in terms of, you know, the way that I go about it, or the way really that any climber goes about it. It's just that Alex trained himself, you know, to a much greater degree than any of us ever have. I mean, to be able to, you know, keep himself together when he was doing some of the crux moves on El Cap. I mean, one of them, the actual technical crux of the climb is something like 2,100, 2,200 feet up. And it's just like, you know, a sheer wall with tiny little holds, some of which I described as being like the size of a eraser on a pencil. And, you know, if he had started to panic or gotten nervous, you know, he could have lost the plot. He could have started to tense up, you know, hyperventilate, like his heart rate, all that kind of stuff, all of which would have made it probably impossible for him to execute the moves that he needed to do. And I just don't think there's another person on the planet, you know, who could have done what Alex did that day, or done any of the other stuff, you know, that he did leading up to this big climb.
Yeah, for listeners who are still sort of wondering about the logistics of this, I mean, there were times when Alex and other climbers in other situations too would have to hang literally from their fingertips, like their entire body weight from their fingertips, maybe on a small ledge, like as you describe, the size of a pencil eraser. This is what climbers, I don't know how routinely they encounter it, but it's not out of the question that they would encounter something like this.
Yeah, no, I mean, that, you know, that's normal for climbers. You know, I try to describe a lot of different types of climbing in the book. And one of the things that I describe, which it sounds like you read, is the most difficult rock climb in the world that was done with a rope. I tried to give people a picture of what that looks like, but it's basically, you know, guys going up, or women, you know, going up overhanging walls, things that are roofs where it's like horizontal and you're hanging upside down like an insect clinging onto holds that are just absolutely tiny, you know, like the size of matchbooks. And then actually like springing through the air and doing dynamic moves from getting to one hold to the other. One of the things that I said in the book is just Google it and look it up and look at videos to get a sense of it, because it's crazy what people are doing. You know, Alex's thing, and you know what he's known for, and what this book is about is him doing that kind of thing without a rope, which is, you know, a lot more rare.
Those who love climbing sometimes call it exhilarating, being that close to death, that engaged in an activity with your whole body and mind. In your book, you have multiple passages where people say that it makes them feel more alive. And you also have passages in the book where you quote people unfamiliar with the sport who criticize it, who say they want that climbers take such huge risks to get that feeling, and they don't think it's quite worth it. So how would you explain why the risk involved in climbing is worth it?
Well, I think you just hit upon it there, which is, I guess it's hard to explain this without maybe having it sound cliche, but I think one of the things that I've learned as a climber, and also from observing Alex and spending so much time with him, is that when you're deeply into the process of climbing, and maybe when you're pushing yourself to your own personal edge, you could call it a peak life experience. And I think it's common for people to step away from doing that kind of thing and feeling like they were really squeezing a lot of juice out of life. And I think, that's why we all do it, because we feel like we're living life, as richly as we possibly can. The other thing about being in positions like that is you are forced to just be in the moment. And when you're climbing, or you're doing anything else like it could be crazy skiing or kayaking or any other sports like that, you sort of forget about everything else that's going on in your life, and you're not really thinking about the past or the future or your bank account or any of the worries that you have. You're just existing in the moment, and that's kind of an awesome thing. Everybody takes their own risk. Even the people that are criticizing Alex, some of them are like sitting on the couch eating potato chips, as he's pointed out to myself. And they're taking their own risks by, not being healthy. And so I've always felt that that's a personal choice. And we have so many people in this world that if some of them want to be a little crazy and see how close they can get to the edge, then, that's their prerogative.
You mentioned in your book how a lot of people seem to want to figure out Alex. They want to know, what about him allows him to scale El Cap without any ropes. And he even has, in one chapter, an MRI to examine his brain to see how his brain experiences fear and compared to, I guess we'll say, a quote-unquote average brain. In your opinion, assuming we should try to figure out Alex, what is it about him that you think makes him capable of achieving something like a free solo climb of El Capitan?
Well, I wrote that chapter in the book. I think it's called Amygdala.
Yeah,
specifically. Amygdala. To try to explore that question. And I felt like I should try to answer it, because I was partly responsible for people even asking that question, because I did a talk with Alex and Jimmy Chin at National Geographic in 2014. And afterwards, this neuroscientist came up to me, and he leaned in and he said, "Hey, Alex's amygdala is not firing, right?" And then I told that story to Alex, and I actually told it to the guy who co-wrote Alex's autobiography with him. And then it kind of entered the sort of public consciousness as Alex's superpower, that he had this defective amygdala in his brain. And I think it kind of bothered Alex a little bit, because it was, an example of people who are kind of writing him off and not giving him credit for the fact that, what he's able to do as a climber is actually a skill that he's attained through a ton of hard work and mental exercises and that kind of thing. So it's kind of a long story, but the conclusion that I come to, and that I think I do a decent job of explaining in the book, is that Alex has an amygdala. Alex's amygdala works. He does experience fear, but he may be a little bit of a genetic outlier. So if there's a spectrum, you could say that he's somebody that it takes more to make him fearful. Like, some people get scared really easily. He's not that type of person. So he was already a bit of a genetic outlier. And then he spent 20 years as a free soloist exposing him to the thing that he was afraid of, to try to turn it into something more commonplace. And one, example that he gave to me is, he said, think about when you first get your license and the first time that you you pull out, you know, from the, road onto the freeway, and how terrifying it is to move into the traffic. But after you've done it for years and years, you can just pull out into the highway, and it's no different from when you get up in the morning and you brush your teeth. And he said, that's how free soloing is for me. I've done it so much that for me to hang from my pinky from a tiny little crack 1,000 feet in the air is the same as, you know, it is for like a New York City cab driver or something like that.
And as you describe that, my palms literally just got really sweaty. Just thinking of having to climb and hang from that high up. But I guess you can get used to anything.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's kind of the point. And I think that's, you know, I hope maybe a takeaway from the book. And, you know, I kind of want people to think about this, because we all have things that we're fearful of. You know, like I'm fearful about something happening to my children. People can be fearful, you know, about having, you know, financial problems, or about their spouse being unfaithful, or, you know, all kinds of things like that. And I think, you know, there's some lessons to be learned from a guy like Alex in terms of how we can, you know, gain a little bit more mastery over these things, because I don't think any of us, you know, feel like it's, you know, a good thing if we don't fully have control over our emotions.
The sport has changed over the decades, and you write about this in The Impossible Climb, about how climbers used to sort of do it. They didn't want to brag too much about it or spray in the climbing parlance. But now it's changing somewhat. I mean, obviously with Free Solo and other film projects, climbers are being filmed, and people who wouldn't consider themselves to be hardcore climbers are sort of climbing, starting out at gyms and then going out into the real world. What do you make of the evolution of the sport? Is it heading in the right direction?
Yeah, people have been asking me that question. And, you know, I guess I would say, as an insider in the sport, I could say that there are some people that are resistant to what's happening right now, which is basically this sport that used to be pretty obscure moving into the mainstream. You know, I do a lot of lecturing, and sometimes I speak to youth, you know, and you can ask the question, like, in a gym full of, you know, students, how many of them have climbed? And like almost every kid's going to put their hand up nowadays, because they're all being exposed to it at one time or another in climbing gyms. Whereas when I was a kid and I started, there were no climbing gyms. And so, you know, it was a very different thing than it was back then. But I guess I would say that I can't personally really see it as anything but positive, because, you know, when I think about everything that I've got out of climbing and what an amazing sport it is and how it's essentially shaped my life and who I am, you know, I don't want that to be something that I just sort of cling to for myself and try, you know, to keep away from other people. So when I see other people out there, when I see the cliff busy, it makes me happy.
At the end of the book, Alex was just finished with his free solo climb of El Capitan, when he's turning his attention to his next adventure, the next big thing. So I wanted to ask you if you're keeping in touch with him as he pursues his next summit.
Yeah, I have been, and you know, his goal right now is the same one that he told me, you know, when I sat down with him right when he came down from the wall. And I told that story, and I think it's, you know, somewhat amusing that he told me that while he was on the wall going up it without a rope, he was already thinking about his next thing. His next thing is to just try to rock climb at a higher level. And that's something that he will do with rope, and he'll be working on it. You know, he's been on this tour to promote the Free Solo film for like the last 6 months. But I talked to him recently, and I asked him how it was going, and I sort of assumed, you know, that his fitness wasn't that good. And he said that he's currently climbing as best as he ever has, And I think he's climbing almost exclusively with a rope now. So, all of his friends, myself included, we're all like hoping, you know, that he's kind of gotten it out of his system. And we've all made a point of telling him, hey, you know, like, there's nothing else, dude, just so you know, like, that's it. You've done it. There is no further you can go, you know, with free soloing. So why don't you hang your hat on that and, you know, keep doing what you're doing, which is, you know, pushing yourself with a rope. Because, yeah, he went further out on a limb, really, than almost any human ever has and lived, you know, to tell the story. And boy, like, if he could just ride that into old age, roll into Yosemite someday with his grandkids and point up at the cliff and say, yep, you know what, I went up that without a rope one day, that would be such an awesome thing.
Well, Mark Sinnott, thank you very much for speaking with me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter.
Mark Sinnott of Jackson, New Hampshire, is the author of the new book, The Impossible Climb: Alex Honnold, El Capitan, and The Climbing Life. And you can find a list of the top five books on Mark's bookshelf at our website, nhpr.org. We're always looking for reading recommendations from listeners like you, so give us a shout. What's your reading recommendation? Send it by email, along with your name and the town you're from. The address is books@nhpr.org. Before we sign off, I want to let you know that our next guest on Writers on a New England Stage is going to be cookbook author and television personality Lydia Bastianich. I'll sit down with her at the Music Hall in Portsmouth on Tuesday, March 12th, to discuss her new memoir, which chronicles her relationship with Italian cuisine and the challenges she faced in creating her own American success story. Visit themusichall.org for more information. Writers on a New England Stage is a partnership between NHPR and the Music Hall in Portsmouth. This is The Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.